Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Augusto Macellari, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
On today's show, we'll be meeting avant-garde musician Holly Herndon, who will tell us why sometimes a musician's best friends are indeed electric.
Then we'll be discussing the final frontier with legendary art house director Claire Denis.
And we'll be looking deep into doodles with the family behind a new book that shines a light on some of the world's greatest thinkers' drawing habits.
That is all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Bill Luthi will be looking ahead to next week's news and we'll enjoy some music right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Hello, Faye.
Hello, Og. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm a bit saddened by the week of grim, grisly drizzle.
Oh, God. It's been very difficult here in London, especially because last year was so nice at the same time.
Yeah, I can't remember even 3 or 4 weeks ago, so I don't have that problem where I'm relating how it was then to how it is now. But I have been envying Chiara Rimella, Monocle's culture editor, who's been living it up in Venice, at the Venice Biennale, and seething.
Are you thinking to go perhaps later in the year? Because they will showcase for a while, right?
Yes, and I would like to go. I won't be going over the summer because I think it gets a bit smelly and a bit busy. But I might go in September, check it out.
I think there'll be something that I would like to go there at some point as well.
It's not as glam when press week isn't on though, is it?
Yeah, maybe go on a quiet weekday or something like that. That's my tip.
How's your week been?
Well, my week has been quiet and a bit drizzly, but it's good to catch up with entertainment, Og, because, you know, we both like to go to the cinema. And there's been a film that I really wanted to see. And finally, I had the time to see Greta with Isabelle Huppert, which we both love as well, I have to say. It's fun, campy, a bit gory at parts. I really enjoy it. It reminds me of The Best of New Jordan from the early 90s, like Single White Female, among others.
Brilliant. I will absolutely go and see that. I love Isabelle Huppert. Well, that's the latest from us, isn't it? So why don't we have a look at the week ahead now with Monocle's very own Bill Luthi.
Which way?
Magical. Welcome, Bill.
Hi, Fernando. Hi, Org. How's it going?
Fine, thank you, Bill.
We're going to do... So you're just talking about culture and enjoying that. We're going to do two cultural things, but we have to start with the serious news.
Oh, eating our greens first.
I know. Sorry.
But I want pudding.
It's pretty juicy. US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has been on a kind of Europe trip. He ditched Angela Merkel to go to Iraq instead. He's going to be meeting up on Tuesday again with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. They hung out last Monday at the Arctic Council in Finland. And, yeah, he's going to go and meet him in Sochi, which would be quite nice at this time of year. It's going to be quite warm. Presumably there'll be a bit of beach resort time. Apparently they're going to be discussing Venezuela's political crisis and North Korea's nuclear programme, but it's pretty awkward between them at the moment. So, I don't know, there might just be some patching up to do.
Especially they have quite different views of the US and Russia, especially when it comes to Venezuela as well. So I wonder if they will find an agreement or something. I don't think so, right?
Well, yeah, at the Arctic Council on Monday, Pompeo said, you know, Juan Guaido is the true leader of Venezuela. And obviously that's in direct contrast with Russia's view. So, yeah, it's going to be pretty awkward. Although quite realistic goals from Pompeo. He said in a in an interview, we have interests that are definitely different, but there was a desire to begin to try and find paths where we can make real progress on places where we do have overlapping interests, as narrow as they may be, and we hope we can achieve that.
So, is that like exploiting the hell out of the Arctic as it defrosts?
Yeah, exactly. Don't care about fossil fuels, use them up, or whatever. But, you know, I think as far as that's kind of honest, the most honest quote I've seen probably from someone within the Trump administration.
Where are we going next?
We are going to, well, a nice, lovely, sunny place, Cannes in South France. It's the film festival. It starts on Tuesday. Probably the biggest, I don't know, it's the film festival I knew about before
the big
I
one.
Knew.
It's the, it's really the big, big one.
It's quite charming. I love the red carpet. I think it's kind of the most glamorous still of them all.
Have you been, Faye?
I haven't, actually, but that's the one that I envy our colleague Ben, who will be going there. But as we know later, I have another place to go.
You're busy next week.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that in a moment. The big films coming out are the new Tarantino film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. it's quite hotly anticipated, I think, as all Tarantino films are, but has he released a good film?
That's the million-dollar question.
I mean,
are we still interested?
Or does anyone really care? It's probably going to be filled with misogyny and mindless violence. I like a bit of mindless violence sometimes, but I don't know. He should probably move over and let someone else have a go, shouldn't he? That's my hot take.
Yeah, why not?
So there's the new film from Luca Guadagnino, who did Call Me By Your Name.
I love that one, Bill.
A beautiful film.
So Luca has a new stuff.
Yes, it's called The Staggering Girl. Again, hotly anticipated.
I haven't seen Call Me By Your Name, but I did watch Suspiria last Sunday, a week ago today, and my mind was blown.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Luca and the attention for detail. I mean, honestly, Call Me By Your Name, I've watched three times. Every time I cry so much.
Yeah.
And it's just so special to me.
On a slightly different tact, The Dead Don't Die, a new film from Jin Jarmusch, which is described as mumblecore zombie comedy horror. It's got Adam Driver, Bill Murray, Selena Gomez, Steve Buscemi, RZA, Tilda Swinton, Danny Glover. It's just got everybody. I think Iggy Pop's in there, and it does look quite funny.
I want to see that one as well. Bill, now the biggest story of the week, I mean, undoubtedly.
I can't believe we've managed to talk for so long without mentioning what's happening on Saturday. Eurovision.
Oh, wow.
It's Fernando's Christmas.
Yes.
Christmas plus. You're going to be in Tel Aviv. I've basically got some questions for you because you're the expert, so I wasn't going to come and sit in here and tell you things. There are lots of favourites, apparently. Can you just list a few of them?
Well, the main favourite's the Dutch entry this year, Duncan Lawrence with Arcade. A perfectly nice song, but it's not surprising. But I think he's in the top three favourites. I mean, it's the Italian entry, Mahmood with Soldi. Such a great song. I mean, good beats. I mean, that's why we play in our playlist as well here at Monaco 24. And he could be a potential winner. And I think it'd be good for Italy because they always like their second place, third place, but they never win for some reason.
They were favourites last year as well, weren't they?
Yeah.
Or maybe the year before
or
up there. We can hear the song.
Let's hear it. Avevi solo i soldi, soldi, come se avessi avuto soldi, soldi, dimmi se ti manco te ne fotti, fotti, mi chiedevi come va, come va, come va, adesso come va, come va, come va.
So I'm getting different looks from both of you. Fernando, you're dancing away. Org, you're kind of, not scowling, but...
I have a question for Fernando. Why do you never have just like really leading pop acts represent countries in the Eurovision? I mean, I don't like him, but why doesn't England wheel out old Ed Sheeran, get him out of his Suffolk retreat and get him to come and sing Galway Girl and wow the Euro
crowd? I'm glad England didn't do that in a way, even though the UK entry, I mean, it's so. But the thing I think with Eurovision, people, you know, supposedly to discover new acts as well. So I think... Even though, remember when the UK sent Bonnie Tyler? Cool, it was a bit gimmicky, but I think the cool thing about Eurovision is to discover new things that perhaps you never heard it before, in a way. But of course, some countries do that. Some countries do send their biggest stars. But I like, for example, Mahmoud. I never heard of him before, of course, I start reading about his entry. It's a great song. And Matteo Salvini hates him, so I think that's kind of
a
good
plus.
Thing.
That's a serious plus.
That's a good thing. Could be good for Europe.
Org, if you didn't like that one, Fernando, what's the weirdest song, do you think?
Well, there is this kind of... techno band from Iceland, and they love a little bit of bondage. Shall we listen to it?
Yeah.
So, I don't have a problem with the weirder ones.
See?
I didn't say that. No.
And you know what? I mean, I don't think they're going to win, but they are, I think, the sixth favourite or something
really?
Like that. Because do you remember when Lordi from Finland won?
Yeah.
And they also invited Netanyahu for a wrestling match as well. So who knows?
Thanks so much for joining us, Bill. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Musician Holly Herndon has been pushing at the boundaries of what's possible in electronic music since her debut album Movement appeared in 2012.
And she's back with a new record this month, Proto, which sees her continue to explore the increasingly blurred relationship between humans and machines. And she's even helped to create an all-new technological entity, an AI program called Spawn, which can be heard all over it.
Monocle's Tom Hall spoke to her on the line from Berlin recently, and Holly began by explaining what that term proto really means.
Proto has multiple meanings here. So proto as in precursor. So when we were thinking about artificial intelligence, we were thinking about the evolution of human intelligence and maybe kind of what the next phase is. If we're in a kind of pre-period to the next phase in the next development in human and artificial kind of combined intelligence. So that's a part of it. Another part of it is for prototype. So we're kind of prototyping a new kind of ensemble, an ensemble that includes an AI, so an inhuman intelligence, and also many wonderful human intelligence as well. And then lastly, it stands for protocol. So looking at, the word protocol basically means kind of whatever agreed upon rule set that people come to consensus about. And so we're thinking about that in regards to technology, how we can kind of embed our human values into the protocol level or layer of the technology that we're developing moving forward.
You mentioned there about inserting a human element into the protocol of how we want, you know, technology basically to evolve over the next few years. I mean, is that something that you agree is missing in technology, a human quality to it?
One thing I think that technology, we often see it as this kind of separate thing from ourselves. And I see it as something that grows out of communities, out of ourselves, out of our shared kind of human intellectual history. So it's not this kind of like alienated other, instead it's kind of a part of us. And so I really like to have an approach towards it where I feel like I have human agency in the technology that I use, that it's not forcing me to move in one direction or the other. Because we still can as a society decide which way we want things to go. I mean, if you look at the way that the internet's kind of gone in the last several years, it's really moved towards a kind of advertising logic. And that's just basically because of the dominant platform corporations that are that dominate the internet right now. So, you know, there was this kind of utopian dream for the internet, and now it's kind of a huge mall in a lot of ways. And it has a lot of incentive built into the design of the platforms themselves that sometimes bring out the worst in us. So yeah, absolutely. I think we need kind of like a human-centered or human-focused approach to developing technology. Yeah, that kind of instills our ethics and values from the get-go.
I kind of have this theory that we're almost like kids with a new toy when it comes to all of this technology that we're suddenly faced with over the last 20, 30 years, which has accelerated at an insane speed. It's almost, I feel like we're just not quite grown up enough to use it. I mean, where do you think that date will come where we're suddenly kind of calm and sort of have a zen approach to being able to use this stuff without using it for just idiotic purposes?
I think it depends on what specific technology we're talking about. I mean, if we're talking about the internet, if we're talking about AI, if we're talking about, you know, each kind of new development brings with it a new ethical framework and a new kind of Pandora's box. The accelerated rate at development is kind of unprecedented in human history. And so we're being asked to, as a society, respond to these developments at a much faster pace than ever before. I don't know if we're ever going to just be totally zen. I think each time, you know, we get used to one, you know, we get used to the telephone and then we have email and then we get used to email and we have Twitter. You know, it's kind of an ongoing thing. But I think we can build a kind of like an ethical framework or way of looking at things that I think can be applied to technology kind of on a broader sense that then can help us to deal with new things as they come along.
So let's talk about the record itself. I've been reading about how you've made it, and obviously this chimes into how you've made a lot of the other records that you've made in recent years, but, you know, incorporating technology in smart ways. But one element of this record is Spawn. Can you tell people what Spawn is?
Yeah, so Spawn is our AI baby. And this is a project we've been working on for about 2.5 years. So myself, Matt Dryhurst, and Jules Laplace, we received a grant in honor of Beethoven, actually, from Germany, to experiment with kind of new technology in music. And so we decided we wanted to work with neural networks. And so Jules is our software developer, and we started reading some various scientific papers. So 2016, early 2017 was a really fruitful year for multiple studies that were released. And so you saw a lot of activity around that time because some really exciting new papers were released. So we started reading them, installing software, and kind of playing around. And we decided to use the metaphor of a child because we felt like this technology was really nascent and exciting, but also really required kind of the careful nurturing of parents and a community in order to kind of guide her in the right direction.
And so Spawn is basically, it's almost like a sort of AI ensemble, right?
I see Spawn as an AI performer, as a member of our ensemble. So our ensemble is made up of more human voices than inhuman voices. So we have a really special group of people in Berlin who all bring their own kind of unique takes to music. And we've been singing together for a couple years now, improvising together. And then Spawn joined us and began training on their voices and performing with us. So it's kind of a new kind of ensemble, I would say.
And I mean, music is obviously an incredibly broad church, but I mean, it does span from, you know, whatever, guys with guitars to kind of cutting edge technology being incorporated, which I would kind of put your work more in that bracket. I mean, do you sort of do you ever worry about people sort of misunderstanding what you're doing as being pure experimentation rather than being a pursuit to make pretty melodies and music, as many other people would see the purpose of music being?
I think people misunderstand me all the time, but that's kind of the beauty of being in the public arena, is having those misunderstandings and then kind of, having those conversations and trying to clarify. I try to, not even consciously, but just from my own desire, I want the work to be something that's viscerally impactful. So I don't think anyone should have to read my dissertation to engage with my music at all. But if one is interested in some of the theoretical or technical kind of thoughts that went into it, then of course, you can dig deeper and learn about that. But I would hope that the music is kind of viscerally understandable as well. And I think that it is. I think you can hear with this, especially with this album, you can hear that people were sharing space together. And that feels like such a rarity these days. Like, it's so expensive to get recording studio time and to have rehearsal spaces and people's time. I mean, that stuff is so rare these days. So to actually have like voices in a room together, emoting and singing, that felt like a huge privilege. And I hope that you can hear that kind of like joyfulness in the music as well.
You definitely can. I wanted to talk about the song Frontier, which you've just created a new video for. But I just found that incredibly emotionally arresting, the vocals on that, you know, this sort of wall of choral voices. Tell me a little bit about where that inspiration came from.
Sure. So I'm from Tennessee, and I grew up hearing about Sacred Harp music, but had not really engaged with it. And then when I was working with the ensemble here, one of my ensemble members, Evelyn Saylor, was part of a Sacred Harp group in Berlin. And so I went to hear them perform here. And the way that it's performed is in a square or a circle where the performers face each other. It's not really for an audience. It's for the performers themselves. And they take turns leading the song one by one in the middle. And if you stand in the middle and you have kind of these voices in surround singing full throttle, it's incredibly emotional. The kind of delivery that's usually used in Sacred Harp music is, it's not like a soft, sweet blend. It's like kind of a really heavy kind of chest, almost a screaming vocal delivery, and it's incredibly emotional to experience. So So that's kind of where the first part of the song came from. And then I didn't want to just do kind of like a historical reenactment or something. I wanted to make it something that spoke to today. So then we remixed it into what hopefully is the banger that it is now. But it also features the unique talents of the group of people I was working with. There's also Stina Motlin is this incredible soprano who's kind of like wailing on top of everything. And, you know, that's kind of the beauty of working with people is you get to know their voices, you get to know, you know, what their kind of unique sonic fingerprint can bring to a project. And so that was really fun to do.
And I also wanted to talk about the videos that you make. I watched Godmother, the video for that, which I found really affecting, just all of these faces kind of blurring into each other. It kind of spoke to me just as in kind of in that sense of like information overload. I mean, we are constantly sort of seeing these avatars, these like little pixelated versions of ourselves and stuff all over the web and things like that. And it suddenly said to me, like, you're just seeing a lot of stuff, you know, like you're seeing a lot of stuff at once. What was it that you were trying to communicate with that video?
We were working with Trevor Paglen and Daniel Costa-Nieves, and we were working with this idea of the eigenface. So there's this thing in machine vision where you can go through all of your facial expressions and then you kind of create an average of that. The computer creates kind of an average kind of like fingerprint of like what your face would look like. So through surveillance technology, if they're looking for your face in a crowd and you're making a specific face, it kind of has that average face. So Jaylen and I sat in the studio to try to make these eigenfaces. And so that's why we're making all these crazy faces, smiling and laughing and frowning and all this stuff. And we really wanted to try to create this kind of almost like monstrous blend of our two faces going through this eigenface process as a kind of reflection of what Spawn really is. And all Spawn really is a reflection of the training data that she receives. So that's kind of the funny thing with AI is it's often presented as this like perfect glossy, you know, technology with kind of no human input in some way. And if you really kind of peel back the curtain, it's all just made up of human labor and human effort and human intelligence that's just kind of been erased with this kind of glossy veneer. So we wanted to show both the kind of roughness of the audio quality that we were getting by using sound as material with neural nets. And also we wanted to show the people, the human beings who went into making the music.
A lot of the conversation that goes on around AI is very sort of doom and gloom, but when you talk to you, you get a palpable sense of, it sounds to me, just at least enthusiasm and excitement. I mean, are you someone who's excited about the future or excited and also maybe a bit wary? I wonder where you sit on that scale.
I mean, I'm definitely both. I think that we have a lot of media that is doom and gloom and kind of dystopian, and I think it's really great to be critical. I think it's crucial that we're critical about the way that these things are developing, and I also hope that I am adding to a critical canon. But at the same time, I also want to create another vision. I don't want to just say, you know, I don't like this, but you know, rather, what if it was like this? So for me, it's not kind of like a positive or a negative. It's really kind of it's almost like an invitation. And, you know, you'll find that in some of the lyrics, like a frontier of green or of dust. Like, you know, we get to decide, you guys. We get to decide if this, you know, turns into a hellscape or if this becomes something really beautiful that helps everyone in their daily lives. So if, you know, the ball's kind of in our court, I like to see us as still having some sort of agency in this conversation. And I think when we just go into the kind of doom and gloom scenario, in some ways we kind of hand over that agency to those who already have power.
And you are nearly finished in a PhD, which is a question that I don't often get to ask many musicians. How is that going? And what are you hoping to find at the end of that, maybe?
That's really great, actually. I just did my doctoral defense in California 2 weeks ago, and they approved me. So that's really exciting. And now I just have to file everything in the library. And I really want to take the longer form text that I made and make kind of a shorter form article so that I can share it with more people. So keep your eyes open for that one.
Holly Herndon there, talking to Tung Ho, and Proto is out now.
And here's a song from the album. Here's Holly Herndon with Swim.
That was Swim by Holly Herndon. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Claire Denis is an auteur in the truest sense of the word. Her influential films have informed the likes of Barry Jenkins, exploring the complicated face of a post-colonial France.
In her latest film, High Life, she takes a broader look. It's an intelligent sci-fi that follows a group of unfortunate convicts as they voyage deep into space, never to come back. It shines a light on the very urges and dynamics that make us human. With Star Turns from Robert Pattinson and Juliette Binoche, it also asks urgent questions and offers an antidote to the usual Hollywood sci-fi. I caught up with her to learn more about taboos, justice and black holes. But first, let's hear a clip.
You lied to us. You knew it.
The sensation, moving backwards. Even though we're moving forwards, getting further from what's getting nearer.
There is nothing to fear. Everything's gonna be fine.
Are you sick? You realize nothing is ever gonna grow inside us.
Break the laws of nature. You'll pay for it.
When I start writing a script, I have few moments I trust, you know, few things I trust, like immediately I knew the man was alone with the baby, that's for sure. And I knew this ship has left Earth since a long time and there was no return possible. I knew it was a kind of jail. I knew those people who have been there, even the young man who is the hero of the film, were convict on Earth. I knew the baby never been born on Earth because she's only a few months. She's 12 months old and the trip is already 7-8 years long, you know. I knew by reading books, I knew there could be a garden, yeah.
At the beginning of the film, the opening lines of dialogue are Robert Pattinson communicating with this baby, talking baby speak, but the two big ideas that are introduced in
Dada
in more adult language are ritual and taboo.
This is later. It's not when the beginning. It's later when he take her to bed after he's throwing away the leftover and the piece and the shit, and he says he explained to her this machine that is recycling everything, because in a place like that, each drop of liquid has to be recycled, you know, and there is this noise constantly. And it's true that in the real experience for space traveling, the recycling system is very important, even not only in films, you know. And it's true that for human beings, recycling of shit for plant, for garden, it's more or less okay, you know, even with the smell. But to imagine you can eat, recycle everything, you know. The only thing I avoid was recycling their own body. I remember I saw a film when I was, oh, you've seen it probably, Soylent Green, where you understand even the body are recycled, you know. And this, I wanted their dead bodies to be thrown away like in the Navy.
Buried at sea, yeah. Buried at space. So for the ship to function, for it to sustain life, these processes have to happen. There have to be there has to be economy in how things are reused. But for the society that it supports to maintain itself, there also have to be these rules that are broadly analogous to the rules of society on Earth. And I suppose what I wanted to ask about taboo and ritual, you know, he talks about the rituals of hygiene, he talks about the taboo of eating shit. Do you think those are two of the underlying things that kind of hold us together as societies?
The taboos are different. Taboos for me is a very special name. It's a word that I guess comes from the Maori civilization, taboo, and it was not only meant for sexual restraint. A taboo in the Maori language, if I remember well, is also if this tree full of fruit belongs to me, it's taboo to you. You know, it's a sort of, there is no border, no frontier, small island. So the taboo is to protect the minimum we need. And also the taboo, probably, they knew that because they live in small islands, to reproduce themselves in small communities was dangerous genetically, you know? And they were warriors, and they sort of create this wars from island to island, or even in the same island, to be able to exchange their daughter, wife, you know, to mix the blood, you know. So taboo is sort of, maybe in the Maori, it's essential, the taboo. As for us today, taboo is moral, which is very different, you know. And maybe when Monte hold the little willow in his arm and he says, my old dad told me eating his shit is taboo, is something that you can, that exists. I don't know if you have children or brother and sister, but I remember in a family of relatives, very close people to me, I remember a little girl, and she was opening her panty, and she was tasting a shit, you know? And it was like, it was not even disgusting. It was like she was experiencing, you know? And then probably, if I remember well, because I was not big myself, somebody slapped her hand, washed her hand, and said, no, you cannot do this, you know? It was hygiene and maybe a little bit of taboo, you know?
Do the characters who are on the spaceship, who are so removed from the rest of civilization?
Civilization is not everywhere, and not always.
True. As a broad brushstroke, then.
Yeah.
I wonder why you wanted them to maintain such a strong sense of taboo, of the rules that govern interpersonal relationships.
In a jail, in a place where people live together on a very small surface, a very small place, like in jail, sex relations are not taboo. They are forbidden, that's all. It's not taboo. It's just forbidden. Because imagine in a jail, if they were allowed, well, it's not possible. And when it happened like in Jean Genet's book, you know, in a way, trespassing the rules, you know, of course. Because of that, the desire is even stronger, of course, when it's forbidden.
As convicts who've been sentenced to death and who've taken on this mission, which is in itself a death sentence.
They are offered, they could have said, no, I don't want, I stay in my death row. They were offered something and they take the chance because it seems they were offered a little bit more, maybe not really hope, but something a little bit more. And also for their families, probably.
Right, which is Andre 3000's character talks about the way that he sees this as a chance to redeem himself somewhat in the eyes of society.
And maybe for his wife and son. Yeah.
But so, well, my question is to you whether you view the judicial system, the penal systems in the West, I suppose, specifically because these characters come, I think, mostly, if not entirely, from America.
From place where death penalty still exists. When I was touring in the state for the film, I remember reading in LA this thing about the Californian senator was questioning Californian about not having any more death penalty. And then suddenly Trump or somebody else says, no, you should keep death penalty. It's security for people.
So is this system, you know, is it about, it's not about rehabilitation, transparently. Is it about revenge for society? What do you see the system as? What function does it perform?
Death penalty?
No, more broadly, the kind of prison industrial complex in America, one that could then reasonably, one that one could imagine
in
sending
France,
people to a death mission to space.
France, I remember the day when death penalty was abolished, like a great day, but I still know that the condition of prisoner in jail are not good, not solved. The space are not proper to good rehabilitation. I know that. And when you come to people with pedophilia or things like that, then it became difficult to decide, or even juveniles, where they should be, in what kind of place they should be to have a hope of redemption is maybe a great word, but to re-enter a possible world.
Does this mission offer redemption, though? I mean, is it rehabilitative in the way that Andre 3000 thinks it is, or is it in fact?
It's for him. He says he did it for his wife and son. He doesn't want his wife and son, his son, to grow up with a mother that knows that her husband is in the death row. At least he's maybe heroic in space fighting a black hole. It gives a sort of destiny to the father, you know? That's what it means. Redemption is a little bit, it's almost a religious word, I guess.
I want to ask about love and life, because space seems like a very lifeless place.
I think for many scientists, it's crawling with life. It's moving. It's birth and death, constantly. Movement, expansion. I think it's very much alive, but of course not for us, because we are creatures born in a very specific system with an atmosphere. Without atmosphere, no more us. But in the cosmos, probably it's not nothing. I guess it's a lot. Yeah.
In the film, we have Juliette Binoche, who's aboard the ship as a doctor who's conducting these experiments on the people. Is her obsessive search for a way to make life work,
shame
new life, on the ship?
She's a shameless.
Is the birth of Willow the first moment of love that we see in the film? Is that where... Is there love before that, between the other people?
We see one baby dead after. Probably there was many accidents in those years, you know. But Willow is the perfect one, alive and strong. And she's proud. She's not in love with the baby. She's so happy, you know.
But Robert Pattinson loves the baby.
But Robert Pattinson never is so... closed, and suddenly everything opens, you know, and he realizes first he's responsible for a life, and he cannot kill himself anymore unless he killed the baby, and then he doesn't want to kill the baby, and little by little it's love. He says, I think, I'm hers, she's mine.
Claire Denis there, and her new film High Life is in cinemas now. You're listening to the Monaco Weekly. More after this.
What's in a doodle? From dispelling stress to passing the time, the doodle is like a physical daydream and comes about as naturally to people the world over. Whether or not one's doodles offer a window to the soul is a tricky question, but one a new book might help to answer, as it presents a rich selection of doodles from some of the world's most influential artists and thinkers.
With scribblings by the likes of Renoir, Hemingway and Fellini, Scroll by Karen, Claudia and Todd Strauss-Schulzen offers an invaluable, ephemeral glimpse into the minds of men and women who shaped our age. And Karen, Claudia and Todd join us now. Welcome all to the Monocle Weekly. Karen, maybe I'll start with you. What do we learn from someone when we look at their doodles?
I think that it gives you a glimpse into, you know, their unconscious. It's this intimate connection and that you feel when, you know, when you see a doodle, that, you know, everyone has this sort of creativity inside of them. Everyone doodles. So, you know, looking at these academic, larger than life figures, you sort of just, you feel like you know them. So it offers you this really intimate connection, and it's a deeper way of experiencing them.
Todd, you and Karen have both contributed a really lovely foreword at the beginning of the book. And I just wondered if we could pick up on that idea of a doodle as a kind of momentary insight. You know, in it you talk about your father, which is really, as I understand it, where this amazing collection has come from. Maybe you could just talk about his love for the doodle. And was it that kind of contact with the workings of someone's mind that he found so compelling about them?
Yeah, our father was a dealer of historic manuscripts and documents and had a business that our mom now runs called Schulzen Autographs. But he had this private collection of illustrated letters that he kept over the years. He would buy lots of other things. And he would keep these rare, one-of-a-kind illustrated things. And we grew up surrounded by these drawings in the house and just very casually around all the time. And there was something, you know, I would go to school and I would doodle in my textbooks, and I would come home and I would be bored in my room and I would sketch on a napkin or something. And then behind me, I would look and he would be looking at a doodle by Renoir or something. And it would seem to almost like flatten out history that maybe, you know what I mean? Like that I'm not so different than Renoir in a way that there's like a whimsical, childlike, unconscious part of all of us. And something about that felt really comforting. And I think maybe he also had a sense of that as well, that it was a great uniter.
Did that bring some kind of pressure to your doodling? Were you kind of conscious that you were doodling in front of a connoisseur of doodles and that he might kind of evaluate yours more critically if he was looking at Renoir ones as well?
No, I don't think so. But he, I don't think that that's true, because I wasn't even maybe aware that I was doodling, although I still do it. I mean, I can feel myself wanting to do it even right now talking to you on the phone. You know, my hand wants to be moving around. But he was also a doodler, our dad. You know, he would sit on airplanes and at restaurants, and he would also doodle himself. I mean, are you doodling right now?
I am, actually. For me, my favorite doodles are the very simple ones. And Claudia, maybe I'll ask you this. One of my favorite ones was by Picasso, I think, closer to the end of the book. It's just so simple. I think he kind of draws like a flower. So it's quite interesting how people's mind work, because then you have Josephine Baker with quite a complex doodle. So it's quite interesting that you have, it's so varied in a way.
It is varied, and I think that the intention behind the doodles also is varied. That Picasso that you mentioned, there are two of them in the book. One is a flower that actually doesn't have a description, and that was part of an autograph album. And it almost looks as if he did that on a request, perhaps. Just a very simple line drawing that almost any of us can do if we want to, which would make us seem very similar to this great, hugely prolific artist.
What was your father's process of researching all those amazing documents in a way? Did he go like to markets around the world? I would love to know more about how he managed to find those amazing pieces.
Well, with being in the business is mainly the way that it's a combination of buying from other dealers, buying at auction, buying from private people, sometimes from sort of obscure art galleries. I don't know if I should reveal this, but that's where the Ensor comes from. There's an Ensor gallery in Ostend, Belgium. Ensor that's in the book came from there. And so really it was a combination of places. And as David got better known for this collection, a couple of people knew about it. They would offer him things. And people are now offering me things in the same way.
I remember being like 14 or 13, and he would take me on these buying trips in Europe. You know, we would go to Paris and London, and we would go to Switzerland, and he would go to buy things, and he would take me sometimes as a kid, and it was like traveling with Indiana Jones or something. You know, he would go to these old libraries in the back and leaf through binders and manila folders that were dusty, and he'd find things for his stock to sell, and every now and again he would find one of these illustrated pieces, and he would just be so joyful. He would, like, he found a treasure, and it's all we would talk about for the rest of the day, and that those kinds of things are what found themselves into this book.
And so here's a question. Was it the thrill of discovering them? You know, when he found them, was he just compelled by any line that wasn't writing that had been done by someone who he admired or who he was interested in? Or was he more discerning? Would he see some and think, actually, do you know what, that one's not interesting to me? What qualities in them spoke to him?
That's a complex question. It's a combination of different things. So, for example, if the creator of the drawing was a rare or a very important person, like Einstein, for example, then whatever would come from whatever, whether it was just a line or a more complicated drawing as the one in this book, then that in itself would be important, just simply because of the rarity. If there's someone who's very, just the number of letters produced by a particular individual were very, very few, and then there was a letter with just a tiny little, I don't know, maybe just a sort of a, what you might consider to be a dot at the end that had a little bit of extra in it, then that would be something that was important. And if there was someone like Henry Miller, who's was quite a prolific letter writer, then there he would be more discerning in what he chose.
So, Karen, to kind of pick up on that, obviously you had this vast collection. How did you guys go about kind of filtering it down? What were your metrics for what merited inclusion in the book? And are there some that you kind of felt that you argued over whether there was some that should be in and didn't make the cut? Or, you know, how did you go about processing it?
Well, it was a really fun process, actually. It was the three of us sitting in our basement going through tons of binders, looking through this amazing collection. And over the years, Todd and all of us, really, we would look through from time to time. We would look through these pieces with our father, and he would give us explanations, and, you know, he would tell us where he found them. And so I think each of us have these memories and these connections to different pieces. So, you know, those were pieces that were really important to us. And we also really wanted to make this book sort of fun and interesting for everyone. So we included people from every category. It's in alphabetical order. So there's artists next to presidents. And so it's really just this full look at and into the collection.
And now a question to all of you. I mean, do you guys have a favorite doodle? Because I am torn between the Picasso one that I've mentioned earlier, but I quite like the Joan Carpenter one as well, which is kind of creepy and it's quite his style in a way as well. So I wonder if each one of you could choose one.
And I should add that you like the Fellini one. Don't try.
I do, but I was not going to mention that.
Well, I'll jump in here. The Fellini one is one of my top two, probably, because I have such a vivid memory of him finding those. He had many of those, many different of those sort of pornographic drawings of Fellini. I have one on my wall of my apartment. But I remember the day that he found those and he brought them home so excited, and he wanted to put them all on the wall. And Mom was like, no fucking way. No way. Those do not go on the wall. Those go in the closet to be forgotten forever. And so that one is in the book feels like a victory. And another one that I really love is the Roland Topor one with the women's heads growing like cabbage in the field. Only because when I was a little, like 6 or 7, that was on the wall, and it would give me nightmares. It would be so, so scary, and he would sort of torture me with that particular one. And so that's a huge piece of my childhood in the book.
I anticipated this question, but for me, it has always been the Saint Exupéry illustration of the Little Prince. And also in the book, there's also the boa constrictor eating the elephant, a little drawing of that. And when I was younger, I loved this book. And I remember growing up, the illustration was framed and hanging outside of my bedroom. So it was just, I just loved it. And it was just this deeper connection for me. So that one obviously also needed to make its way into the book.
And for me, my favorite, is the drawing of the World War II airplane by Winston Churchill that saved Britain. And that is because Churchill has been, for most of my life, one of my most, a hero, one of the most important people that I learned about when I was young. And so when David found that drawing, I immediately said, no, we have to frame that, and you can never sell that. And so that sits in a frame in my living room.
It's lovely, and I'm really struck, you know, I've just been looking through them all. One thing that I really like about this book is, I mean, the alphabetical ordering of it just presents everything side by side. There's no hierarchy between the different drawings. And it's just made me wonder, you know, what your reflections are, just as we kind of come to an end, about where the line exists between a kind of a doodle and an artwork. The Picasso ones you mentioned maybe were done for a fan. The Little Prince kind of appears almost as he does in the illustrations to the book. And I wondered whether you distinguish between doodles and when an artist does it, works of art, or is there no distinction to be drawn, really?
Well, they're both pointing to me, so I guess that's a question that I'm going to answer. That's the question. And when we were first presented with the title, Doodles, I objected a little bit for that exact reason. If you look at the Renoir, there's a sketch, it's a fairly big sketch in the Renoir drawing where he's explaining a room, how something is supposed to be exhibited in a room. And that looks more like an intended sketch rather than a doodle. There's a couple of other ones that are exactly in the same. I'm just looking at the cover of the book. The dog by Calder. That looks like an actual intended drawing rather than a doodle. The two doodles, I would say, by Eisenhower are clearly doodles on a meeting agenda. It's White House stationery on a meeting agenda. That just seems like he's bored at a meeting and he's just drawing away, not paying any attention. So I think there's a distinction in fact, but I think for this book, the distinction doesn't really make a difference.
I think also for us, you know, the reason why the design of the book is as it is and we wanted Rizzoli so badly is because we wanted to frame this work as art. I mean, to us, some of this stuff is almost cooler than having a piece of art on your wall because there's context and there's story. And so a lot of the selection and the design of the book is helping to frame it as art.
And I think the last thing I would say is the idea of, you know, if an artist does something, you know, to be capital A art, or just does some throwaway sketch, or a regular person, you know, doodles just on their own, is there really a difference? I think the beautiful idea of the book is that everyone's got this impulse to create and this unconscious artist inside of them. And the relaxed nature and casual quality of just picking up a pen and creating something that reveals itself to you is kind of what a doodle is, you know? So I like the idea that these artists are doing things that maybe aren't capital A art, and so do we. And that's what the book celebrates.
Our thanks to Karen, Claudia, and Todd Strauss-Schussen there, and their excellent new book, Scrawn, is out now on Rizzoli Press. You're listening to the Monaco Weekly. What a great show, huh?
It was lovely. We had some really interesting guests on this week, I think.
So fascinating to hear more about doodles, in a way, because it's something that everyone does it, but I don't think I've ever seen a book about the most famous doodles.
I know,
around.
And there are some great ones in there. Yeah. It's just a kind of compulsive thing, isn't it? They were they spoke very beautifully as well, I thought, about their father's collection and what it meant to them as a family.
What a great show. And of course, you speaking to Claire Denis as well, such a respected director. I need to see her life. I haven't seen it yet.
Yes, and a character to boot. Yes, you must see it. It's phenomenal. Everyone must see it. But I think maybe they should go and watch it now because we've finished.
Exactly. Well, thanks, Og.
That's all for edition 514 of the Monaco Weekly. Today's show was produced by myself, and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. We'll be back again next week, as per. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Augusto Macellari.
And from me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Goodbye.